Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Ed Mitri here, your friendly neighborhood parasitologist, here to talk to you about even more worms. I don't have any financial relationships or relevant commercial interests to disclose. So today we are going to talk about the major helminth pathogens that we did not have the opportunity to talk about in the live session. And so we're going to start off with trematodes, which are the flukes, and we will go over the liver flukes, the lung flukes, and the intestinal flukes. So let's go ahead and get started. So in general, you know, just when we think about flukes, these are flat, fleshy, leaf-shaped worms. They usually have two muscular suckers. They're typically hermaphroditic, except for schistosomes. Schistosomes are dioecious. They're boy and girl schistosome worms, but the rest are generally hermaphroditic. They require intermediate hosts, usually a snail. And prosiguanal treats generally all of them except for fasciola species. So let's talk about fasciola. So fasciola is one of the hepatobiliary flukes, sometimes known as the sheep liver fluke, because it is usually or often infecting ruminants such as sheep. But humans can get infected, and we become infected when we eat Metasercaria that has insisted on vegetation, usually something like watercress. There are two species of fasciola that infect humans. The major one, the most common one, is Fasciola hepatica. It really has a worldwide distribution in tropical areas, and areas with the highest prevalence are countries such as Bolivia and Peru. There is a less common fasciola species known as Fasciola gigantica. It's called that because those flukes can grow over 7 centimeters in length. Much less common, present in parts of Africa, Southeast Asia, and the Pacific. So what happens here? Well, a person acquires the infection by eating the larva on aquatic vegetation. The flukes migrate to the liver, and then they migrate through the parenchyma of the liver for weeks, really, and it's very painful, and it causes inflammation of the liver. So you get this right upper quadrant pain and hepatitis. After 3 to 4 months, they typically arrive from the liver parenchyma into the biliary ducts, and they mature. They can then cause biliary inflammation and induce biliary obstruction. These are diagnosed typically by finding eggs in stool, but the sensitivity of stool, ovum, parasite exams, even repeated assays, is not terrific. There is serology, but it can be challenging to obtain. A treatment of choice is triclobendazole, which was actually FDA approved in 2019. So there are two other important hepatobiliary flukes you should know about. One is Clonorchis sinensis, sometimes known as the Chinese liver fluke. This is present in China, Japan, Eastern Russia, Korea, and Vietnam. And the other one is Opisthoccus viverrini, which has a little bit of overlap in geography, but is mostly present in Southeast Asia. These, unlike fasciola, which is acquired by eating aquatic vegetation, these are acquired by eating freshwater fish. The flukes develop in the duodenum and then migrate to the bile ducts in the liver. And they live in the biliary tree 4 years. They can easily live over 10, 15, even over 20 years. They make a lot of eggs, and they're very inflammatory. They're actually considered class 1 carcinogens, and so they predispose to cholangiocarcinoma. They can also cause biliary obstruction and cholelithiasis. Next up is Paragonimus westermanni. This is the lung fluke. And this is really a helminthological mimic of tuberculosis because people, when they present with Paragonimus westermanni, usually present with a chronic lung condition that can present with focal consolidation, shortness of breath, and cough, not too dissimilar from someone that has tuberculosis. How is this acquired? Well, typically this is acquired by ingesting undercooked freshwater crabs or freshwater crayfish. The flukes in this case migrate to the lungs. There is often an eosinophilia a peripheral eosinophilia with paragonimus. But I've talked to colleagues who have had cases, and sometimes the eosinophilia isn't there, or when they look back over the course of several months, intermittently, the eosinophil count was elevated. So it's not always there. And the symptoms are generally pulmonary. During the acute migration, people can have intestinal symptoms and even frank diarrhea, but really it's going to be a cough, chest pain, and shortness of breath. Intermittently, you sometimes hear of cases with fever, but fever isn't that common, except maybe a little more common during the acute phase of infection. So again, months of pulmonary symptoms, and the diagnosis is actually looking for eggs in either or both, looking both at the sputum and at the stool for eggs. And again, there is serology that this can also be challenging to obtain. One thing to know for the boards is that we do have a species of Paragonimus present in the United States, and that's Paragonimus kelicotti. There have now been several cases, well over a dozen, that have been described. And generally, this is acquired by people that are eating raw or undercooked crayfish in rivers in Missouri or tributaries. So much of Middle America along the Mississippi. The clinical scenario here would be someone who ate a crayfish on a dare, or someone who is trying to do survival living on their own while they're camping in the United States. And if they eat some crayfish and they develop a chronic pulmonary disease, you want to think Paragonimus kelicotti. All right. The final fluke category we will talk about are the intestinal flukes. And I don't think these will be commonly asked about on the boards, though they might be used as distractors. There are two main ones. One is Fasciolopsis buscae. This is known as the giant intestinal fluke. It truly is giant. Fasciola gigantica, which I mentioned earlier, can grow to over 7 centimeters in length. Fasciolopsis buscae, the giant intestinal fluke, can grow to up to 8 centimeters in length. Like fasciola, fasciolopsis is acquired by eating larvae that have insisted on aquatic vegetation. Now, usually people with fasciolopsis will be asymptomatic, but heavy burden of infection can cause loose stools, frank diarrhea, abdominal pains, even ulceration, hemorrhage, and in some cases, fever. Diagnosis is found by finding eggs in the stool, so just typical stool, ovum, parasite exam. And then there's Metagonimus yokogawi. This is a much smaller intestinal fluke, about 2 to 3 millimeters in length and less than a millimeter wide. Now, this is acquired by eating undercooked fish, and it can cause diarrhea and abdominal pain. Okay, well, that is it for the trematodes in this Even More Worms talk. Next up, we're going to talk about a couple of cestodes that we did not discuss in the live worm talk. So before we do that, I just want to do a quick mini review on what we're talking about when we're talking about a cestode. So cestodes are tapeworms, and all of them, except for D. latus, have suckers with surrounding hooklets on their scolex to attach to the intestinal lining. Remember that a scolex is not really a head. It's just a grabber. We don't call it a head because it doesn't have, like, eyes and a mouth. It just has, these structures that it uses to attach to something. The rest of the tapeworm has a little neck region and then lots of proglotted segments. The proglotted segments contain the reproductive organs. They also have some muscularis. Tapeworms do not have an intestinal tract. They actually, and so they don't really have a digestive system. They just absorb their nutrients through their body wall. If for some reason you wanted to invite a tapeworm out to a dinner party, you wouldn't give it a fork and knife. You would just give it a big bowl of soup, and it would just hop in, dance around, and absorb the nutrients that are outside of it. All right, so this is what tapeworms are, and we're going to discuss two in this talk. And the first one is Hymenolepis nana. This is sometimes referred to as the dwarf tapeworm. And it's called that because compared to the other tapeworms, which can be very, very long, meters in length, H. nana, it's quite tiny, only about 4 to 6 centimeters long. That said, it's almost certainly the most prevalent cestode infections of humans. It is found worldwide. Now remember, when we discuss tapeworms, we always want to be thinking, who's the predator and who's the prey? The predator typically harbors the full tapeworm in the intestinal tract, and the prey harbors the larval form in the tissues. Now, in the case of H. nana, the typical life cycle is going to be rodents as the predators, so they have this tapeworm in their intestinal tract, and beetles that have the larval stage in their bodies. Humans, however, can be hosts to this. And what's interesting is that we can get infected by directly eating a grain beetle. And you might say, well, how in the world would that happen? Well, sometimes little beetles get crushed up in our grain. And if we eat it, and it's infected with Hymenolepis nana, we can get infected with H. nana. Interestingly, though, we can also get infected by ingestion of eggs in contaminated food or water. Most people with H. nana are asymptomatic, but when people develop very large parasite burdens, they can get symptomatic. They can get some loose stools, a little diarrhea, some crampy abdominal pain, and maybe even some weakness. Diagnosis generally straightforward. Stool, ova, and parasite exam typically will reveal eggs. Sometimes people see small little proglotted segments in the stool or at the anal verge. So a parent might confuse the proglotted segments of H. nana for pinworm, but it wouldn't respond to typical pinworm medicines because in this case, you would need praziquantel to treat. Unlike something like pinworm, this is not a roundworm. So the proglotted segments one would see would be pretty flat and small. I have the life cycle on the next slide, and I don't think anyone's going to quiz you on the life cycle, but just it's pretty interesting, this tapeworm infection in humans, for a couple of reasons. First, because we can be infected with both life cycle stages. We can be infected from the larval stage in the beetle, but we can also be infected by ingesting eggs from food or water contaminated with either human or rodent feces containing those eggs. And then what's interesting is that typically, you know, say someone ingests a larva in a beetle, it will invade and then develop in the intestinal tract and grow into a full worm and then release eggs. But this can cause auto-invasion in people. It's interesting that we can be infected by multiple stages and that this is one of the few worms that can complete its life cycle inside of us. All right, the only other tapeworm I wanted to comment on briefly is Echinococcus multilocularis. Now, in the live session, we talked about Echinococcus granulosus. In general, for the boards, I think if multilocularis comes up, it is going to come up as a distractor. The reason is that I think the naming is just confusing. When we see multilocularis, we think of something that's loculated. Now, this is a wonderful image here from a case report of a person that had both granulosis, which is much, much more common than multilocularis, which is so this person was infected with both at the same time. And you can see on the left side of this image is a classic echinococcal cyst with multiple cysts and septations inside of it and a well-circumscribed border. In contrast, on the right side of this, you see what multilocularis looks like on CT imaging. Even though it's called multilocularis, grossly and on imaging, you don't see loculations. Essentially, what you see is a poorly defined heterogeneous mass that seems to have a semi-solid nature, and it has poorly defined borders. Now, this is actually caused by Echinococcus multilocularis. The usual life cycle of Echinococcus multilocularis is from foxes and other canines as the predators, and rodents or other small little mammals as the prey. And this can occur actually throughout much of the world, but it's not very common. And a person would get infected if they ate food or water contaminated with stool from foxes. So a person eats the eggs, and then we develop the larval form inside of us, and it grows as this lesion. Now, Echinococcus multilocularis is quite uncommon, certainly far, far less common than Echinococcus granulosus. It can be a much more severe disease. It essentially grows as a tumor. It can metastasize throughout the body, and it's very difficult to treat. Typically, one would do a combination of surgery plus very long-term antalgics. But that's Echinococcus multilocularis. All right. Well, we are done with our trematodes and cestodes, so we are done with all the helminths in the phylum of platyhelminths. So all the flatworms we have completed. Now we move on to nematodes, which are in their own phylum, Nematoda, and these are roundworms. And we're going to start off first by covering a couple of intestinal roundworms. Just as, again, as a quick refresher on what we're talking about when we talk about a nematode, we're talking about non-segmented roundworms. These are very different than annelids, which are in their own phylum. So these are non-segmented roundworms in the phylum Nematoda. They have a flexible outer coating called the cuticle. They have a muscular layer under the cuticle, and they are really pretty advanced and developed little animals. They have nervous, digestive, secretory, and reproductive systems. People can get infected with nematodes in all manner of ways. So people can get infected with nematodes by eating eggs in fecally contaminated food or soil. That's true for Ascaris, that's true for Trichuris, which is whipworm. It's true for pinworm and for Toxocara. People can get infected with nematodes by direct penetration of larvae through the skin. That happens with the organisms that are hookworms, Ancylostoma and Nicator, and with Strongyloides. They just go right through the skin. Now, if I was giving this talk live, I often pause here and I say, what other organism can infect through the skin? And the answer, just take a moment to think about, you know, what other infection of humans can go right through the skin? And the answer is schistosomes, which is blood-dwelling flukes that we talked about in the live session. So it is interesting that helminths have this ability, certain helminths, to penetrate directly through completely intact skin. Another way people can get infected with nematodes is by eating food containing infectious larvae, and that's true for Trichinella, Angiostrongylus, and Anisakis. And then there's vector transmission, really for the filarial pathogens, Wuchereria, Brugia, Onchocerca, and Loa Loa. Let's do the couple of intestinal nematodes we're covering in this Even More Worms talk. We will start with Paracapillaria filipinensis. So this is primarily found in Southeast Asia. People acquire paracapillaria by eating raw freshwater fish. Most people are initially asymptomatic when they have a small worm burden, but this parasite can complete its life cycle inside of us. Over time, people develop borborygmus, which is what we clinicians use when we just want to really say rumbly, grumbly belly, but we're a little embarrassed to say that. But anyway, people develop a rumbly, grumbly belly, they get abdominal pain, and then watery diarrhea. If this infection is not treated, however, it can progress. And over months, the diarrhea gets worse, and people can develop electrolyte and fluid losses, which can lead to death. So how in the world does that happen? Well, it happens because this can complete its life cycle inside of us. After ingesting raw fish, the larvae of paracapillary go into the intestinal tract, burrow into the mucosa, they mate, and then they develop and they can release eggs, and they can sometimes they can even just release live-born larvae. And so you get more larvae that infect the same intestinal tract, develop into adults, and then produce more eggs and larvae. Over weeks to months, the worm burden can increase from just a few worms to tens of thousands. And so this can be a fatal process. Paracapillaria, the eggs look very much like whipworm eggs. Well, I don't think the board exams will ever ask you to identify a helminth on the basis of an egg, but they might show you an egg with like, you know, a page long stem for the question. And if you know what the egg is, you can get it right away. So for what it's worth, the eggs of paracapillaria look very much like the eggs of whipworm. So you can see on this image to the left here, where it says TT over here, That stands for Trichuris trichura, and that is whipworm. And it's kind of this oval football-shaped egg with these bipolar plugs. And down here, we have what used to be called Capillaria filipinensis. Now we call it Paracapillaria filipinensis. But it also has polar plugs at each end. It's just a little more rounded than the whipworm eggs. So diagnosis is by stool, ova, and parasite exam. And treatment is typically 10 days or so of albendazole, as well as fluids and electrolyte repletion. The next and final intestinal nematode we will talk about today is Enterobius vermicularis. But this is maybe the most important nematode that in the United States we need to think about, because it's certainly the most common one that is encountered in clinical practice. Now, as infectious disease clinicians, we're not often asked about pinworm because it really falls into the care of primary care physicians, pediatricians, family practice physicians. But, sometimes ID gets called about this. And when we're called, sometimes it's because there's a case where, someone in a family just keeps presenting with recurrent pinworm infection. So a couple of comments about pinworm, general notes. First of all, this organism, it's found pretty much everywhere. Transmission is straight up fecal-oral. The eggs, so most eggs of most helminths take a while, sometimes several days, until outside the body, until they become infectious. But pinworm eggs become infectious really very quickly, just within hours after being released. Humans are the only host, and the most common symptom is perianal itching. Though I have had several cases now where the predominant symptom in a young woman was vaginal itchiness, and those cases were misdiagnosed as candida infections when really the person had pinworm. And both of the cases I'm thinking of in my head were caregivers. One person was working basically as an au pair or nanny, and someone else worked in a daycare. So perianal itching, but I think on an exam it would also be fair to ask about symptoms of vulvovaginitis. Can pinworm cause other things? It can, but not very commonly. So there are case reports where pinworm can cause nausea and abdominal pain, and it can cause appendicitis. The main symptom, though, is perianal itching. Now, here's the deal. The deal is that when we think about pinworm, we sometimes think of it just as a bit of a nuisance infection. But in reality, it can, even though it's not the most morbid infection, it doesn't like break down any specific organ system, perianal itching can be pretty terrible. And it can just cause families to be completely exhausted and at wit's end, really. So a couple years ago now, I took care of a family that was referred to me because this was a family where there was a husband and a wife and three or four children under the age of 5 or 6. And everyone in the family kept getting pinworm. And they had undergone several rounds of therapy and nothing seemed to be working. And I spoke to the husband and wife and I talked about what they had done and how this was affecting them. And basically, it had just turned their whole world upside down. The kids were waking up throughout the night. The parents couldn't sleep. The parents were exhausted. They were very frustrated by this condition and were just kind of grasping for anything to do. And so they told me about all sorts of non-traditional approaches they took to take care of this. And one of them was they had read that spicy foods can be helpful for pinworms. And so they decided to go on a diet of just eating Indian food, which to me actually sounds fantastic. But I talked to them and I said, oh, so you did that? Well, how was it? And he said, well, really what we did is we learned how to cook chana masala and we made it spicy and we got our kids together. And I'm not making this up. This is actually what I was told. He said, so we did it for 2 weeks, got all the kids. We all got together in the room. We had chana masala for breakfast, chana masala for lunch, chana masala for dinner. And, that diet, I love chana masala, but I don't think I'd want to eat it, three meals a day for weeks on end. And I only bring it up to just really push home the concept that it can be very disruptive to the life of an individual or a family. Okay, so how are we going to diagnose this? Well, usually you don't really need to order lab tests for it because most of the time, if someone taking care of an infant tells you the infant has pinworms, you can just go ahead and take their word on it and just give them empiric therapy. But in cases where it's a recurrent problem, you do want to make a definitive diagnosis because maybe it isn't pinworms, even though that's what the family is talking about. So remember that for pinworm infection, the eggs are released by the worms at the perianal verge. So they're not actually coming out with the stool. So stool, ova, and parasite exams have very low sensitivity. What we want to do is a pinworm paddle test. And you can do this in the office, or you can actually give someone a pinworm paddle and have them self-collect at home. The test should be done early in the morning before showering or defecating, and multiple tests really increases sensitivity. So when we hear of cases that are very difficult to get rid of, and I'm asked to like give advice on it, I tell people, let's do, you know, do at least three or four of these pinworm paddle tests if the initial ones are negative. And then when you look at them on microscopy, the eggs are very refractile, typically look kind of like a squashed out oval with one flat side. All right, so how are we going to help a family or someone that has pinworm? Well, we don't have anthelmintic resistance here. When people have recurrent infections, it's because the infection is ping-ponging around family or their environmental sources. And so general guidance is to say, listen, Mom, Dad, I know you guys don't have pinworm, but we're just to be safe, we're going to treat everybody in the household for pinworm. And I always start with parenteral, much less expensive than albendazole or mebendazole, and it's quite effective. So you treat everyone, and then 2 weeks later, we're not even going to think about it. We're going to retreat everyone. And then during those 2 weeks, we make sure that everyone carefully trims their fingernails, washes their hands. Sometimes they tell family members not to share towels for a couple of weeks and to wash bedclothes and towels and sheets a couple of times during that 2 week period. And that usually works. If you have a case that's much more challenging than that, always feel free to give me a call and I can give you, you know, Ed's advice on how to eliminate a pinworms from a household. Okay. Question. I decided that, you know, for the latter half of this talk, I would include some questions, which I think is a little silly because I don't have anyone in front of me to answer the questions. But hey, just play along if you're in the car or at your desk and let's just give it a shot here. Okay, so this is a report that was published by another group. A 13-year-old girl developed an itchy rash on her foot after moving to rural Northeast Florida. And we have this wonderful picture here where for all the world, it looks like a worm is crawling underneath the skin. So you see this serpiginous rash that itches. Which of the following is the most likely cause of that kind of rash on the skin? Is it anaerobius, which is pinworms? Is it ascaris? Is it whipworm, Trichuris trichura? Is it toxocarotenus? Or is it Ancylostoma caninum? Take a second to think. And the correct answer is Ancylostoma caninum. This is cutaneous larva migrans. This is caused by dog or cat hookworms trying to infect humans. Now, Nicator americanus and Ancylostoma duodenale, hookworms of humans, those larvae will come in through our skin, but then they will get through the deep dermal layers. They'll migrate to the lungs and eventually to the intestinal tract. But zoonotic hookworms aren't able to penetrate the basal membrane of the dermis. And so they just get stuck there. And so they're just migrating in the upper layers of the skin. And so there are a lot of species that can do this, but the most common ones are Ancylostoma caninum and brasiliense and Uncinaria stenocephala. The worms migrate laterally, and this can go on for several weeks. Eventually, the worm will die, but we can just treat the person typically with a couple of days of ivermectin is the drug of choice, or you can give a few days of albendazole as a secondary option. One of the challenging aspects of cutaneous larva migrans is that the presentation can occur up to a month or two after exposure. So if someone tells you they were in the tropics where there were some wild dogs around and they were at the beach and they come in with a rash like this, you know, a week after visiting, which, you know, is a little early, but say 2 weeks after visiting, then it might be easy for them to put this together. But if it's 2 months after, it might not connect as easily in their mind. So always important to take a good travel history. And remember that even with cutaneous larva migraines, there can be a couple month incubation period before there are clear clinical symptoms. All right. So the final part of this talk is going to be on tissue invasive nematodes. And so we will go ahead and cover the ones that we didn't cover in our live worms talk. So let's start off with trichinellosis, one of the classic parasitic infections. This is a tissue invasive nematode that goes into muscle cells and just totally transforms them and makes them into nurse cells and takes over our bodies that way. So people get infected by eating larvae in infected muscle. And so typically the meat of a wild boar, wild pig, a horse, bear, I should have put bear on there because bear is pretty common, and sometimes in wild game. So a person eats undercooked meat, the larvae get released from the cysts in the muscle by the actions of gastric acid and other ways that our body has to digest muscle tissue. And so the larvae are released, and then they invade. And they invade, actually, the small intestine. And during the first 2 weeks of after exposure, the symptoms are predominantly, if they're present, intestinal, where a person might have abdominal cramps and maybe even diarrhea if there's a heavy infection. Now, I will tell you, trichinella is amazing because those larvae that come out of the muscles, they penetrate into the intestinal mucosa and then molt four times in 40 hours. And then mate, they copulate, and then they start releasing about 2 weeks after infection, 1 to 2 weeks after infection, all these newborn larvae. Now it's the newborn larvae that, you know, basically go from the intestinal tract that go out into the tissues. The adult worms only live for about a month, but it's those newborn larvae that go out and then insist in our muscle cells. And when that process is occurring, it can be very painful, especially if there was a large burden of adult larvae that were eaten in the muscle. So because the larvae go to striated muscle, this causes muscle pain. It causes edema. Now, edema is most readily seen in areas where we don't have a lot of soft tissue, which is probably one of the reasons why there's very evident periorbital edema. So people are looking at their faces and we don't have a lot of soft tissue around our eyes. And there is eosinophilia. So muscle pain, periorbital edema, and eosinophilia of the larvae can also go to the CNS and the heart. You can actually have a myocarditis from this. Sometimes there's fever, sometimes there's hives. Diagnosis is usually on the basis of history. Serology can be supportive. If one were to do a muscle biopsy, sometimes one can, you know, if one is lucky enough, see the cysts in a muscle biopsy. That would be definitive. Treatment is usually steroids plus albendazole. And then I include a life cycle picture here in case my explanation didn't make sense to you. You can see there's both, you know, pigs and bear and other animals that can harbor this and put people at risk. Okay, next tissue invasive nematode we will discuss is Anisakis. This is really why things like eating raw fish and sushi, I just don't understand it. Now, realistically, I do understand it. It's totally fine. The reason it's fine in the US is that in the United States, we have requirements for sushi to be frozen before it's served. And the freezing process and the requirements are such that it's sufficient to kill anisakids. So if anyone ever offers you, for example, fresh sushi from a fish they just caught, the answer is no, you do not want to eat that fish. Anisakis actually has a pretty complex life cycle, but people acquire it by eating larvae in raw or undercooked seafood. This is really found worldwide. The larva in the seafood can be anywhere from 1 to 3 centimeters in length. And when a person eats that raw fish, if it hadn't, you know, been frozen sufficiently long enough before that, that larva will come out and it will try to penetrate into the gastric mucosa. And so actually, it can cause acute pain and vomiting really within a day or two after eating sushi, sometimes within just hours. So that's the main clinical presentation, is going to be pain, nausea, vomiting shortly after eating undercooked or raw fish. There is another clinical manifestation of anisakis, and that is that some people who think they have fish allergy actually have worm allergy, and they are sensitized to anisakids. And so they eat fish. It could be cooked fish. There is some dead anisakids in there, but they're allergic to it. They're IgE sensitized, and so they can develop hives, itchiness, and it can go all the way to the extreme of anaphylactic shock. For acute anisakis, the treatment actually can be endoscopic removal by upper endoscopy. For allergic symptoms, if it's really to anisakis, one would want to avoid eating contaminated fish. Next up is angiostrongylus. Now, I actually think angiostrongylus is something all of us need to be aware of. If I had more time, I would always include it in the live talk, because I think it's a helminth infection that is probably emerging throughout the world. And it's a bit of a problem. It is the most common parasitic cause of eosinophilic meningitis worldwide. So as a board hint, if you get a case of eosinophilic meningitis and you don't have time to read through the stem, but you just notice, oh, eosinophilic meningitis, angiostrongylus is a good guess there. It does appear to be increasing in range. I have a citation here to a wonderful review article that talks about endemic areas where this has been found, which is all the areas in red, and just something to be aware of. Okay, so how do people acquire angiostrongylus? They acquire it by eating raw or undercooked snails or slugs, or freshwater shrimp, like basically freshwater crustaceans like shrimp or prawns, but even freshwater crabs and frogs. And then, because the snails often have angiostrongylus in it, actually eating fresh leafy greens like lettuce can be a risk, because sometimes there are snails or snail parts that have contaminated the lettuce that has the angiostrongylus in it. So angiostrongylus really causes two diseases. The main one to remember is that it is eosinophilic meningitis, which is caused by angiostrongylus cantonensis, and that is present, as you can see on the map, through much of the world. Classically, it was China, Southeast Asia, Japan, Australia, the Pacific Basin, Hawaii. But you can see other places have it as well, including the Caribbean and Africa. And the problem here is because this angiostrongylus cantonensis is also known as the rat lung worm. And when the larvae, so the rat will eat a snail or a slug, they'll get the infection. And when the larvae goes into the rat, where it really wants to go is into the right ventricular outflow tract of the rat. Basically like heartworm, which is dirofilaria, in dogs and cats, it's kind of like that, but this is not a filaria. This is a different genus, or different, totally different category of helminth. But it wants to go into the right ventricular outflow tract of the rat. But to do so, after eating the snail, the larvae actually migrate around the meninges of the brain before getting into the vasculature. And so in humans, when we get the infection, the larvae migrates, you know, it comes in, you know, we eat something, penetrates the intestinal tract, but then the larvae get caught up in our meninges, and they can even go into the spinal cord, and they can cause an eosinophilic meningitis and other forms of CNS damage. And it can be quite morbid, though most people resolve the infection without many long-term issues. So that's angiostrongylus cantonensis, eosinophilic meningitis. The other form of disease caused by angiostrongylus is caused by angiostrongylus costaricensis, which is present in Central and South America. And this causes a persistent inflammation of the GI tract. It's sometimes known as abdominal angiostrongyliasis. I think it's important to know angiostrongylus on the boards, because the boards like to ask about ID issues in the news in the last 2 or 3 years. And but Between June of 2021 and January of 2022, there were three cases of eosinophilic meningitis due to angiostrongylus that occurred in Florida. Now, we've known that we've had angiostrongylus in Hawaii for a few decades now, and there's often between, you know, 2 to 12 cases per year in the state of Hawaii, and the Department of Health in Hawaii is excellent in terms of recognizing and trying to minimize angiostrongylus. In Florida, we've known now for probably at least a decade that both rodents and snails in many counties in Florida have been harboring angiostrongylus. So that life cycle has been there, but we hadn't seen cases until 2021 and 2022 where there were three children. So there was a 19-month-old who presented with refusal to walk. That child had been eating sand at the beach, was considered like the likely source. There was a 10-year-old who presented with 3 weeks of worsening headache and vomiting. That 10-year-old had actually eaten a snail about a month before being admitted and had eaten the snail on a dare. And then there was an 8-month-old who presented with fever, vomiting, lethargy, and left-sided esotropia. The possible source of ingestion was not really known in that child. All three children had pretty long hospitalizations. The 10-year-old even had to be intubated for a while, but all seemed to recover and all received some mix of steroids plus minus albendazole. I have the citation here if you want to look at it. Interestingly, in all three cases, angiostrongylus was identified by testing the plasma via cell-free DNA next-gen sequencing, and that was using the Karyus platform. The CDC does offer, I believe, angiostrongylus PCR testing, and you can always reach out to them. And the Department of Health in Hawaii also has resources. But it's interesting that, you know, this next-gen DNA sequencing was able to identify this worm or the DNA of this worm just by testing, you know, peripheral blood samples. So how do we prevent this? Well, from the Hawaii Department of Health, you know, don't eat raw or undercooked snails or slugs, freshwater prawns, shrimps, crabs, and frogs. Inspect and rinse all produce, especially leafy greens. And one should really wear gloves when handling snails or slugs and wash one's hands after handling snails or slugs. In areas where there's a lot of endemicity, rodent eradication and freezing of mollusks and crustaceans is also advised. Diagnosis, for the most part, is usually presumptive, on the basis of eosinophilic meningitis and an exposure history. Serology is not easily available, but there are serological tests that have been reported. And then there is PCR, and you can reach out to Hawaii. NIH sometimes is a research assay, and the CDC to see if they're running it. Treatment is corticosteroids and usually combined with albendazole. Okay. So I have two more questions in this part of the talk. So a 6-year-old boy from Indiana has a pet dog, and he likes to play in a sandbox. He presents with fever, hepatosplenomegaly, wheezing, and eosinophilia. He's never traveled outside the U.S. What is happening? Eosinophilia and fever and, you know, large liver and spleen in a 6-year-old boy. So this should be pretty straightforward. In the United States, the most likely causative agent is which of the following? Is it Anisakis? Is it Onchocercovolvulus? Anaerobius vermicularis? Toxocaracanus? Or Ancylostoma brasiliense? And the answer is Toxocara. So this was probably Toxocaracanus because that was one of the options. Other helminths that can cause, so that case was a case of visceral larva migrans. And the most common causes of it are zoonotic ascarids, such as Toxocaracanus, Toxocara cati, and the raccoon ascarid, Balus ascaris, sometimes pronounced Blascaris, Procidonis. Humans acquire this infection by acquire visceral larva migrans by ingestion of eggs in dog, cat, or raccoon stool. And so a sandbox could easily be contaminated with stool from one of these animals, have some microscopic eggs, and a child accidentally ingests it. In humans, the larvae will hatch in the intestine and then migrate to different organs in the abdominal tract and can also go to the lungs, the brain, and even the eye. And so In 2 to 5 year olds, what we typically see is the syndrome of visceral larva migrans, which was the syndrome presented in the case that, you know, we just had the question about: fever, eosinophilia, hepatosplenomegaly. Sometimes there will be some wheezing. Sometimes there will be evidence of of pneumonia. In older children and in adults, what we see more commonly is ocular larva migrans. For some reason, the larvae more likely migrate and they go to the retina. And that retinal lesion can actually sometimes appear as a solid tumor, but a lot of times it is linear, and the ophthalmologist can sometimes readily diagnose it as likely ocular larva migrans. In general, Bayless ascaris is typically more severe than infection with Toxocara canis or Toxocara cati. And Bayless ascaris is the one of these three organisms that's the more likely one to go to the CNS and cause eosinophilic meningitis. I mentioned before, eosinophilic meningitis, you should probably answer angiostrongylus, but really any of these zoonotic ascarids can also migrate up and cause an eosinophilic meningitis, and it's well recognized with Bayless ascaris. So how do we diagnose Toxocara? We would diagnose it by the clinical picture and by serology, and there is serology that is available. But you have to be careful with a Toxocara IgG, though, because a lot of people are just at baseline seropositive for Toxocara IgG. For visceral larva migrans, the treatment is usually self-limited. Acute visceral larva migrans or ocular larva migrans can be treated with steroids plus albendazole. And I didn't write it on the slide, but ocular larva migrans can also be treated with laser phototherapy of the nematode in the retina. So just two more worms, and then we will be done with this talk. The next one is Nathostoma spinigerum and Nathostoma hispidum. These are nathostomes, and they are nematodes. And the key word to remember is ceviche. So if you hear the word ceviche, they're trying to get you to guess nathostome. This is acquired by eating undercooked freshwater fish, as well as frogs, birds, or reptile. It is fairly common throughout Asia, parts of Central and South America, and parts of Africa. Now, nathostomes can cause many different clinical manifestations. But if the board's going to ask about them, it's going to ask, or it's going to present a case where someone has painful migratory subcutaneous swellings. So nathostomes can cause a cutaneous larva migrans-like picture, but usually they're causing inflammation that's a little deeper, more of a subcutaneous inflammation. And it's challenging because sometimes that those migratory swellings come and go over a period of several months. Now, nathostomes can cause other clinical conditions, including visceral larva migrans, eosinophilic meningitis, a radiculomyelitis, and both anterior and posterior uveitis. How do we diagnose nathostomes? It's challenging. There's no antibody test available in the U.S., and usually we're not able to get the worm. So a lot of times it's just an empiric diagnosis. Very rarely is it diagnosed by biopsy. Treatment can be quite challenging and often requires multiple weeks of albendazole. This is the final worm we're covering, and it's just really quick. I have it in parentheses in my list of major Helminth pathogens because this is no longer a major Helminth pathogen. Oh, if you look at this picture, I have the answer on it anyway, so you should know what this is. So what is the emerging guinea worm? It is Dracunculus medinensis. Oh, and I should have mentioned, if you're listening to this talk on a car ride and not looking at the slides, there's a picture of a person's hand, and there's many, many, many centimeters of a very long, thin, white worm that has come out partially from a blister that developed in the wrist of somebody's hand. So this is Dracunculus medinensis. It is no longer a major Helminth pathogen because since the 1980s, we have really put in a lot of effort to eradicate this. There have been global eradication campaigns since the 1980s, and they have been tremendously successful. We're generally down to less than 10 cases per year. But it's such a classic Helminth infection, but I figured I'd include the picture because that's something that could be asked on the board. This is acquired by people eating copepods, which are these small little tiny crustaceans. Sometimes people call them water fleas that are harboring the parasite. 1 year after swallowing an infected copepod, the worms develop and migrate through the soft tissues of a person, and they can grow quite long, over 2 feet long. And about a year after being infected, the adult females will create a little blister and then poke out of that. And when a person walks in fresh water, release larvae into the fresh water. Now, that emergence of the worm is extremely painful, and it predisposes to bacterial superinfection, and it can lead to disability for months. None of our anti-helminthics work well against dracunculus, so treatment is very slow and careful, manual extraction. This is the worm that they pull out by twisting. You know, one can pull it out by twisting it very slowly on a stick, but it's not all at once. You do a couple centimeters a day for days to weeks. And we can prevent this infection really just by filtering water is the predominant way. And it's pretty easy to filter it out because you just have to filter out those copepods, which are actually pretty large. So even fine cloth is sufficient to remove the copepods from water. The reason eradication has been elusive is we thought when the eradication efforts started that there were no reservoirs for dracunculus, but it turns out some animals can be reservoirs, especially dogs. And that's probably why we haven't been able to completely eliminate this infection. But for the most part, this has been a tremendous success in terms of global public health. And with that, I am pretty much done with my talk. I just want to give a quick caveat, which probably doesn't really need to be said, but I was asked to cover an extremely large number of helminths in just two relatively short talks. So everything I covered really was a bit on the superficial side and kind of the more common manifestations, just to help you remember some of these worms for the boards. But remember, in practice, everything, of course, is going to be more complicated. I mentioned for eosinophilic meningitis, the most common thing you would want to answer on the boards is angiostrongylus. But if you look at this slide here, I list all of the different nematodes that can cause eosinophilic meningitis, plus there are trematodes and cestodes that can do it as well. And then on the right side of the slide, of course, there's a whole differential for non-helminth infections and non-infectious causes of eosinophilic meningitis. With that, good luck with the boards. I hope you enjoyed the worm talks. If you ever have a challenging case and want to talk, tropical infectious diseases or worms with someone, please feel free to reach out by email. Take care.